time, weather, and...
And during the worst drought in 500 years, it could mean disaster.
It rained so hard in North Texas, the water simply had nowhere to go.
It's 6 o'clock in New York City.
BBC London 94.9.
In the last month or so, I've heard suggestions that those skeptical of Al Gore's spiritual crisis are deniers.
We have record dry weather that is gripping areas from the East Coast all the way to the West Coast. The extreme drought is already forcing major water restrictions in towns around the country. And in the hardest hit areas, things are getting so bad that entire lakes are beginning to disappear.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, your weekly dose of news and views from a troubled planet. I'm your host, Alex Smith. On today's program, we dive into the confusion. TV news footage shows us record droughts and floods in the same week, in the same country, in both the United States and Australia. It's all part of the new climate explained by experts on our show 2 weeks ago. A hard rain's gonna fall. At the same time, voices from the left seem to have joined the ExxonMobil school of global warming deniers. We'll hear a short clip from former funny man turned super patriot Dennis Miller as he trashes climate change. And we mourn the credibility of Alexander Coburn, the famous leftist icon who has gone off the rails. We have a full Radio EcoShock feature on that, which is already circulating widely in the blogosphere. Then we leave the babbling males and fossil-fueled grown-ups to hear a passionate speech by Vancouver's own Severin Suzuki, daughter of the famous broadcaster and environmentalist David Suzuki. She tells delegates at the United Nations it is time they grew up. Wrapping up the show, we delve into the dance between the peak oil crowd and climate change. Will we run out of oil first, or just give it up because the climate is being wrecked? Stay tuned for that as Julian Darley, another BC energy activist, interviews ex-Greenpeace oil guru and scientist Dr. Jeremy Leggett. It's a busy show. Let's get to it with a shocking lapse of judgment by Nation columnist and lefty voice Alexander Coburn.
You're searching up and down the dial. But it's getting more and more difficult to find relief. Thank God for the refreshing change people can find right here.
A few weeks ago, the well-known writer Alexander Coburn, who's one of the editors of Counterpunch, wrote an article that I think surprised everyone, certainly I was surprised, called From Papal Indulgences to Carbon Credits, Is Global Warming a Sin? And in that article, he basically asserts that the human carbon footprint is of zero consequence.
It's really crazy stuff, and it's very sad, really, because I've had a great deal of respect for Alexander. An awful lot of people on the left have respect for Alexander, and he's blowing a lot of it.
When some right-wing pseudo-fascist nut is convicted or discovered in the bedroom of a little boy, something inside me accepts. I want to cheer, but I don't, because it shows we are all kind of crazy in some way. But at least their hurtful rants become sidelined in the great debates of the day. Thank God, if there is one, we don't have to listen to Jerry Falwell anymore. When an icon of the left falls, someone who has warned and enlightened us, it is much harder. That's what makes it so painful to announce the virtual death of one Alexander Coburn, or at least the passing of his credibility. This transplanted Irish-Scottish writer has blasted malfeasance and authoritarian violence from the pages of Counterpunch, The Nation, and many mainstream publications. He has been chums with Noam Chomsky and pals with many of the gonzo journalists who keep us all honest. But now Coburn has joined the Exxon-funded cranks who deny that humans are heating up the planet with their pollution. Go ahead and fill that gas guzzler, people. Don't worry about a thing. Alexander Coburn believes that oil is infinite. It will never run out, because all the geologists in the world are wrong. Oil wasn't made from compressed plant life. The whole core of the earth is filled with oil, and it will ooze out forever. He knows this because one scientist, building on theories from Stalinist Russia days, says it is so. Coburn steadfastly believes in abiotic oil, the endless supply. And you don't have to worry about global warming either. pump up your coal plants and gun that Hummer, baby, because humans have nothing to do with climate change. If the world is warming at all, Coburn tells us in a recent series of articles, nature is doing it, not us. He knows this because he once met a man on a boat who told him, and that is enough to trump all the climate scientists. You don't even have to believe your own eyes. Never mind the superstorms, the Arctic melting, the winter that never was. You can relax about all that, because Alexander Coburn has discovered an alternative reality, a new truth that only he and a few desperate souls on the far left can see. I feel better already. Millions of Americans, Canadians, and fossil fans everywhere will cite the writing of Alexander Coburn as a source. The pro-oil websites and right-wingers like the Heartland Institute have already linked to Coburn's new denial literature. Today, we mourn the credibility of one of our own, Alexander Coburn. I take this personally, and I'll tell you why. In my beloved British Columbia, in this chain of mountains by the sea, huge and wondrous pine forests are dying and already dead. From space you can see the red swaths of dead trees, mile after pitiless mile, killed off by global warming. Where winters were cold enough to kill off the pine bark beetle, suddenly they are not. And this pest is killing every pine of the Rockies and threatens to invade the northern prairies as well. We've lost a magnificent realm of forests, because the winters just aren't as cold as they have been for thousands of years. I'm sad about that, and angry about the intellectual fools who spin out skimpy lies to divert us from saving what is left of the ecosphere, as humans have known it, during our short stay here. Former friends and admirers have tried to reason with Mr. Coburn. UK columnist George Monbiot has pleaded for an explanation, or at least a dialogue. All that comes out is more craziness, a hole dug deeper in denial. Monbiot and others have given up, realizing Coburn has become a crank, fixated with ideas that cannot be changed by reality. Actually, Alexander Coburn is part of a trio of new additions to the Climate Deniers' Hall of Shame. He is assisted by two Canadian intellectuals, university professors who are battling their own schools, and all of science. These are David Noble and Denis Rancour, and we'll get to them in our next radio feature. Unlike Coburn, these academics do have something worthwhile to add to the debate. Let's investigate the investigator, Alexander Coburn, spelled C-O-C-K-B-U-R-N. Born a Scot but raised in Ireland, Alexander Coburn brought the rebel's outsider view to a number of American publications. He was published in the New York Review of Books, Esquire, and Harper's. He started a column in the Village Voice called Press Clips, but it was kicked out in 1983. The Voice claimed he accepted, quote, a $10,000 grant from an Arab studies organization in 1982. Coburn has been very critical about Israel, Zionists, and the treatment of the Palestinian people. Some Jewish writers and intellectuals call Coburn anti-Semitic, but the label hasn't stuck in the left, where criticism of Israel is allowed. Thereafter, Coburn picked up a regular column in the political paper The Nation. It was titled Beat the Devil. He is co-editor of an online journal called Counterpunch. Along with Noam Chomsky, Coburn has blasted U.S. foreign policy in Central America, and militarism generally. He roasts the leadership of the Democratic Party as too tame. In the year 2000, when he supported the presidential candidate Ralph Nader, Coburn and co-editor Jeffrey St. Clair brought out an anti-Gore book called Al Gore, A User's Manual. You can buy it from Amazon for $1.26. This loathing of Al Gore may be behind his persistent attack on the science of climate change. In his Counterpunch article, May 12th, titled Hot Air, Cold Cash, Who Are the Merchants of Fear?, Coburn writes, quote, the world's best-known hysteric and self-promoter on the topic of man's physical and moral responsibility for global warming is Al Gore, a shill for the nuclear industry, and the coal barons from the first day he stepped into Congress, entrusted with the sacred duty to protect the budgetary and regulatory interests of the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Oak Ridge National Lab. White House task forces on climate change in the Clinton-Gore years were always well freighted by Gore and his advisor John Holdren, with nukers like John Pape of Bechtel, end quote. Too bad he cited John Holdren, the president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and a top Harvard scholar, who doesn't know that Holdren, unlike Coburn, is just a dupe with no scientific credibility. He's just a spokesperson for those, quote, grant-guzzling climate modelers and their internationale, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, end quote. And they are all pawns in Al Gore's game. In fact, we shouldn't be surprised by the recent series of strange articles with his one-man theory of climate change. Coburn has been consistently nutty on this subject. In March 2001, Coburn's article in the Free Press was titled Greenhouse Gas and Global Warming, The Great Delusion. He finds climate change is nothing to worry about, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, are a bunch of extremist doomsters. His deep throat source is one Pierre Spray, former government analyst, statistical expert, and veteran of many battles over inflated eco-catastrophic predictions. Actually, Pierre Spray, the climate expert, turns out to be one of Robert McNamara's whiz kids at the Pentagon, deeply involved in the design of the F-16 fighter plane. He quit in 1986 for a new career, recording jazz music. Who couldn't fall for those credentials? His August 23, 2001 Beat the Devil column followed up with a bit more of global warming plots somehow cooked up by a combination of bad Democrats and, wait for it, the Bush administration. Somehow Coburn managed to link climate modelers to biological warfare research. He reassures us, once again, that humans have nothing to do with climate change. We might as well fill up our gas tanks and rev up our motors, he advises us in another column, October 15, 2005, called The Virtues of Gas Guzzling, Why I Don't Believe in Peak Oil. For this wild theory, Coburn has yet another personal expert, the radio physicist Dr. Thomas Gold. Dr. Gold says oil is a renewable resource, constantly replenished by the Earth. Sadly, the dead and dying oil fields of the United States have yet to be refilled by this magical process. So what is Coburn saying now? It started with an article in Counterpunch of May 2, 2007 titled, From Papal Indulgences to Carbon Credits, Is Global Warming a Sin? He writes, quote, There is still zero empirical evidence that anthropogenic production of CO2 is making any measurable contribution to the world's present warming trend. The greenhouse fearmongers rely entirely on unverified, crudely oversimplified computer models to finger mankind's sinful contribution. Devoid of any sustaining scientific basis, carbon trafficking is powered by guilt, credulity, cynicism, and greed, just like the old indulgences, though at least the latter produced beautiful monuments. End quote. He then goes into a pseudoscientific supposed proof that, quote, it is impossible to assert that the increase in atmospheric CO2 stems from human burning of fossil fuels, end quote. Unfortunately, his array of facts is so skewed that the folks at realscience.org, who debate actual climate science, hardly knew where to begin to unravel all the errors. Where did he get this stuff? He met a man on a boat who told him so. Coburn writes, I met Dr. Martin Hertzberg, the man who drew that graph and those conclusions, on a nation cruise back in 2001. He remarked that while he shared many of the nation's editorial positions, he approved of my reservations on the issue of the supposed human contributions to global warming, as outlined in columns I wrote at that time. Hertzberg was a meteorologist for 3 years in the U.S. Navy, an occupation which gave him a lifelong mistrust of climate modeling. Trained in chemistry and physics, a combustion research scientist for most of his career, he's now in Copper Mountain, still consulting from time to time. Quote. Who is this wonder scientist that confounds the experts world over? Hertzberg is an ex-Navy man who later worked as an explosions expert for the Bureau of Mines. So he would know. He has been hired as an expert witness by Big Coal, especially when mine workers are killed by explosions. He has been paid by the coal industry. According to Hertzberg, and utterly believed by Coburn, water vapor is the force melting the glaciers of the world and wrecking outdoor ice hockey in Canada last winter. Yes, there is much more water vapor in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. Yes, water vapor is a powerful greenhouse gas in its own right. But scientists know that water vapor operates in known cycles, within certain bounds, and cannot by itself force a change in the climate. Water vapor reacts to changes in the Earth's temperature. As the Earth heats up, the air will become generally more humid. But that increase in water vapor doesn't cause itself. Something else changes, namely all the industrial and agricultural pollution we pour into the atmosphere. But wait, Coburn has another explanation. It's the sun. He drags out the old idea of the Serbian physicist Milutin Milankovic, who proposed that tiny alterations in the Earth's rotation were responsible for the alteration of ice ages and hot tropical periods. This may or may not be true over vast ages, but it doesn't explain the rocket-fast changes we are seeing now. It doesn't seem to occur to Alexander Coburn, the newly minted authority on climate, that whole herds of scientists all over the world have carefully considered and rejected all these arguments. That is because, wait for it, the world scientific community is just part of a conspiracy, likely led by Al Gore, and maybe even the Jewish bankers behind everything, to fleece the gullible public with wild stories about climate change. Those scientists, Coburn claims, wade out into the swamps and huddle in Antarctic huts because they are, quote, the beneficiaries of a $2 billion a year global warming grant industry, end quote. Well, it hasn't been much of an industry up until now. Exxon makes $1 billion a day, and they have paid out much better money to other climate deniers like Patrick Michaels, who at least was originally a real scientist rather than an aging political pundit. When even his friends on the left ask Coburn for answers, all they get back is more name-calling and even weirder claims to fringe science. Pushed to find another expert, beyond Mr. Hertzberg, Coburn goes dumpster diving through the net for backers for the denier camp. He finds Professor Zbigniew Jaworowski, who doubts that ice cores can tell us anything about the previous history of the atmosphere. The paper Coburn cites was published in the 21st Century Science and Technology magazine. Despite the impressive name, that isn't a scientific journal at all, but the long-standing mouthpiece for the Lyndon LaRouche organization. LaRouche is the granddaddy of conspiracy nuts, claiming the British Queen heads an international drug organization, and Jewish bankers control the world, presumably including China and India and Japan. As each article becomes more strident and defensive, Coburn finds, quote, a conspiracy of interest between the greenhouse fearmongers and the nuclear industry. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is for Coburn, quote, an army of functionaries and grant farmers and the merest sprinkling of actual scientists. Then Coburn cites the work of Dr. Patrick Michaels, an American scientist paid by the electricity providers and Big Coal, who has fudged other people's scientific papers in testimony to Congress. Coburn believes Michaels, now at the Cato Institute, rather than any of his old friends or those international experts. We don't need peer-reviewed scientific papers, he says. That's all a fixed game for suckers. He throws around figures and isotopes as though he is the real scientist, lately trained by what he found on the web. As evidence that peer-reviewed science is a la croc, Coburn steers readers to Canadian University Professor David Noble at climateguy.blogspot.com and Denis Rancour, a self-proclaimed activist whose first-year courses were recently dropped. Rancour argues that we can't really know anything by science, even though he is a physics professor teaching at the University of Ottawa. More on these two will follow in a separate piece. Coburn's other big source is Frederick Seitz, chairman of the right-wing George C. Marshall Institute, funded by ExxonMobil. Seitz also worked for R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company to, quote, refute the criticisms of cigarettes. Anyone will do as a witness. So long as Coburn is right, whatever he says, and you, all of you experts and fools, are wrong. You can find all the gory details in a column by George Monbiot, published May 31, 2007, and available either at monbiot.com, that's M-O-N-B-I-O-T.com, or at www.zmag.org. Z Magazine Online has a great summary of the Coburn articles, his two Canadian supporters, and the rebuttals from people like Michael Mann, Justin Poder, and Joshua Frank. That's at zmag.org/debatesglobalwarming. Obviously, Coburn isn't just skating on thin ice. The heat has melted everything out from under him. He's drowning in a ridiculous pose thrown out, perhaps, to gain more attention. The problem is, Coburn isn't likely being paid by Exxon, despite his past links to Arab funders. He really believes that whatever he says is true, no matter that the whole world disagrees. That, my friends, is the definition of a crank.
Here's George Monbiot talking with the host of Uprising on KPFA, a Pacifica program, about this controversy. It happened on May 21st, 2007.
George, let's talk a little bit about some interesting controversies around the issue of global warming that we've seen in recent days on the left, someplace we might not expect to see it. A few weeks ago, the well-known writer Alexander Coburn, who's one of the editors of Counterpunch, wrote an article that I think surprised everyone, certainly I was surprised, called "From Papal Indulgences to Carbon Credits, Is Global Warming a Sin?" And in that article, he basically asserts that the human carbon footprint is of zero consequence.
It's really crazy stuff, and it's very sad, really, because I've had a great deal of respect for Alexander. An awful lot of people on the left have respect for Alexander, and he's blowing a lot of it. For the past 3 weeks, I have had a challenge issued to him to provide his references for the so-called scientific claims that he made in that article. He has not met that challenge. He has not provided his references. And I think I know why. It's because there aren't any. Now, those of us who have degrees in science know that for a claim to carry scientific weight, it has to have been published in a peer-reviewed journal. Alexander has based all his claims on a conversation he had in 2001 with a man he met on a boat. This man isn't even a climate scientist. He trained once as a meteorologist many, many years ago. He did a degree in meteorology. He is scarcely better qualified than you or I to dismiss the entire canon of climate science. But for some reason, Alexander Coburn has just jumped on this and says, it's not happening because this man says so. And he obviously doesn't understand anything of science. He hasn't responded to any of the critiques made of the claims that he's put out, and some very serious critiques indeed. You can read them on realclimate.org, where climate scientists have assessed what he's saying and said it's just complete nonsense. You can read my critique on znet.org, where I've been challenging Alexander to a debate and challenging him to produce his references, and he's failed to do so. And the way in which he's turned his back on the requirements that he produces his references and that he engages with his critics, but at the same time continues to say, there's not a problem, don't worry about it, suggests that he is being completely irresponsible on this issue.
Following weeks of public and private requests for a bit of scientific proof to back up the Coburn anti-warming rants, columnist George Monbiot has given up. In a June 13th article, he writes, quote, "I have now learnt that it is pointless to seek to argue with Coburn, because he cannot admit that he got the science wrong. He merely raises the volume and widens the scope of the attack. Resorting to grapeshot, he now invokes just about every crazy theory ever raised by those who say that man-made global warming is not happening. It would require an entire website to answer them all. Happily, it already exists, www.realclimate.org. And, over the years, it has dealt with every new issue he raises, drawing on peer-reviewed papers. But Coburn will not read these refutations. He has answered none of his critics. He has not even listened to them. For this reason, this will be my last posting in this debate. I sign off with sadness. I have followed Alexander Coburn's writing for many years, and I have admired it. His has been an important and persuasive voice on many progressive issues, but I can no longer trust it. I realize that he is blinded by a conviction that he remains right whatever the facts may say. In his determination to admit nothing, he will cling to any straw, including the craziest fulminations of the ultra-right, and he will abandon the rigor and skepticism that once informed his journalism. I feel this as a loss. I'm sure I'm not the only one." So says George Monbiot. Really, I think Alexander Coburn wrote his own virtual obituary in one of his columns, this one skewering those who think that the Bush administration knew or benefited from the 9/11 attacks on America. He speaks of theologian David Ray Griffin as, quote, "the high priest of conspiracy nuts whose cult members, quote, disdain all answers but their own." Sadly, that is a fitting self-description of this one-time icon, now floundering on the edge and grabbing for any right-wing supporter he can find. Is Alexander Coburn falling down the well-oiled slope that took Christopher Hitchens and former comedian Dennis Miller into the super-patriotic camp of Bush supporters?
these pundits always fall to the right because that's where the real power and money lives. How strange that a man who began in the 1980s with a book on wrecking the Amazon rainforest now uses his mind and his pen to paste over the climatic death of forests right here in North America. It is not Al Gore who issues papal indulgences for carbon sins, but Alexander Coburn. We need some kind of clinic to bring these old-time intellectuals back to reality, where droughts, floods, rising oceans, and heat determine people's lives. A kind of Betty Ford clinic for all those pundits who make a buck or re-stimulate a failing career by denying the obvious truth. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find the print version of this with links at www.ecoshock.org/podcast. Find my weekly radio show on various college and community radio stations or download it from our website at ecoshock.org. You are listening to the Radio EcoShock Show. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. I should tell you that Mr. Coburn is pretty lonely out on his ledge, denying the human role in climate change, except for his oil and coal buddies. Even his co-editor at the leftist journal Counterpunch, Jeffrey St. Clair, has made it very clear that he knows that global warming is happening and we have a role in it. Writing on the net May 13th, St. Clair says, "The Earth is warming. We did it. Gore won't solve it." Since the publication of Alexander Coburn's latest assaults on the link between the burning of fossil fuels and global climate change, I've been inundated with hundreds of emails from counterpunchers demanding to know my position. I thought my views had been clear for many years, but I'll take this opportunity to summarize them. 1. The planet is warming once again. 2. This latest period of warming is largely caused by the accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere. 3. The CO2 clotting the Earth's atmosphere is mostly produced by burning fossil fuels and by deforestation and slash burning. So yes, human activities are largely responsible for the current phase of climate change. Even the most strident scientific critics of the IPCC do not dispute this anymore. Most of the scientific contention is over the rate of future warming, not causality. 6. As I understand it, the water vapor critique is something of a canard. Water vapor is indeed an important greenhouse gas, but it is a feedback response, not a forcing mechanism. Water vapors also reside in the atmosphere for a relatively short time, 14 days or so, compared to the 20 years for CO2 emitted for the burning of fossil fuels. Another of Coburn's co-hosts and co-authors, Noam Chomsky, says climate change is one of the three greatest threats facing humanity and the world. So there you have it. There are two Canadian academics who go along with Coburn's strange fantasy of denial, York University historian David Noble and a physicist in Montreal, Denis Rancourt. We'll get to them in a coming show. Meanwhile, back on planet Earth, whole swaths of the planet are being hit by a double-barrel phenomenon of record-breaking drought punctuated by unheard-of flash flooding. This is what I tried to explain in a whole show 2 weeks ago with the help of climate scientist Noah Diffenbaugh. If you missed our June 8, 2007 show, you can download it from our website at www.ecoshock.org. It's called A Hard Rain Gonna Fall. Now, if you can't hold more than one thought in your head, tune out now, because two things are happening at the same time as the climate warps. On the one hand, as the Earth heats up, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor. This airbound water must come down eventually, so we can expect heavy rains in some parts of the world. Those rains become freaky for reasons we are just beginning to grasp, likely due to the effect of all the billions of pollution particles humans put into the air. These particles can cause raindrops to gather and become larger than normal. Here's what happens when they do.
Now to those deadly floods in Texas. Residents are trying to pick up the pieces today, a day after the water rose fast and furious. NBC's Don Teague is in hard-hit Halton City, Texas. Don, good morning to you.
Those floodwaters in North Texas took a terrible toll. This morning there are 5 people confirmed dead and 5 still missing.
We have counted at least 6 houses with people sitting on the roof waiting to be rescued.
It rained so hard in North Texas, the water simply had nowhere to go. Up to 10 inches of rain fell Monday in just a few hours, poured through a mobile home park.
I've never seen it up to here.
The water rose so fast, Sam Gerald couldn't get his family.
The same kind of event just flooded an entire valley in Australia, where the ground was baked hard from a long-lasting drought.
40,000 tons, full of fuel and at risk of breaking up. The Pashabulka lies stranded in shallow water off Newcastle, north of Sydney. Attempts to refloat the tanker have failed as unusually severe weather continues to cause chaos across the east coast of Australia. Thousands of acres of land underwater, farms and their cattle stranded, and all in a country that just a few months ago was suffering from its driest summer on record. For some, it was a lucky escape. Others, though, were less fortunate. A 29-year-old man was killed when a falling tree crushed his car. Police also recovered the bodies of an elderly couple whose vehicle was swept off a bridge. Away from the main road, some were stranded, emergency services airlifting them to safety. Rescue work continued through the night in towns north of Sydney. Buildings were searched, residents forced from their homes and given shelter elsewhere.
Yeah, we just couldn't get out. Just everywhere we turned, just blocked off by water. Just torrents of water everywhere.
I've never ever seen water like this. I've never seen cars floating down Hunter Street before.
Emergency services have been drafted in from neighbouring states to help evacuate nearly 5,000 people from their homes. Much of the Hunter Valley is now underwater, rivers breaking their banks across the region. On the ground, rescue workers are struggling to help farmers and their livestock. More than 130,000 homes remain without electricity after power lines were brought down, and officials have warned it could be days before the lines are repaired. The storms stretch south to Sydney, the flags on the famous Harbour Bridge ripped by the force of the winds. Boats were washed ashore, light aircraft damaged, and roads transformed into beaches. Meteorologists have warned of more storms as the worst low-pressure system for 30 years continues to hang over Australia's east coast. Mark Stone, Sky News.
These hard rains are not only damaging and deadly, they are useless for agricultural production. They run off right away. They wipe out crops rather than watering them. Another huge flood hit China this week, but you won't hear much about that. No camera crews equals no news. But don't let these flood stories cover over the long-term problem that the American South and the Australian South are facing. These droughts are decades long, and some eminent scientists predict the drought could last hundreds of years.
We have record dry weather that is gripping areas from the East Coast all the way to the West Coast. The extreme drought is already forcing major water restrictions in towns around the country. And in the hardest hit areas, things are getting so bad that entire lakes are beginning to disappear. Jessica Yellen reports now from one of the hardest hit spots.
Fighting fires, smoky skies, brown lawns, and shrinking lakes, people across this country are feeling the sting of record dry weather. In drought-stricken Atlanta, neighbors are snitching on neighbors for watering when they're not supposed to. And in bone-dry Southern California, where the Hollywood sign almost went up in flames just weeks ago, officials warn about a potentially record-setting fire season. There's extreme drought in parts of California, Arizona, eastern Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, and Georgia.
Hopefully we'll get some benign tropical weather systems that'll bring some good rains to the region.
The hardest hit, Florida. More than 500,000 acres are burning across the state. Wetlands are becoming dry land, and an essential water source, massive Lake Okeechobee, which once looked like this, is now just shy of reaching a record low. This pier was once in deep water. Because of this drought, the water supply for more than 5 million people in southern Florida alone is in jeopardy. Officials worry the drought will stretch through another hot, dry summer. For Good Morning America, Jessica Yellen, ABC News, Lake Okeechobee, Florida.
Climate change has disturbed the major wind patterns of the world. If we have to generalize, the hotter oceans and land have driven rain-bearing winds closer to the poles. That means Australia's rain is falling on the Southern Ocean, closer to Antarctica instead. And rains destined for California or New Mexico are being carried into northern Canada. British Columbia had a huge snowpack this winter, 150% of normal depth, while hardly anything fell in the mountains further south, and there were fires in the winter in California. You are familiar with news about people from Mexico and Central America migrating north to the southern U.S. states. Now get ready for a wave of Americans leaving the waterless south for Canada. And northern British Columbia will become much more habitable by 2050, according to even the mildest climate predictions.
Winters will be milder, the growing season longer, and rains plentiful. Even the forests will change, as we'll hear in an upcoming show. Last night, I recorded a panel discussion by forestry experts, including predictions about how tree species will migrate north as the planet heats up. And if you are under the age of 40, this will happen in your lifetime. People are in shock. Eco-shock. That's why they need to hear famous voices tell them everything is okay. Just go on about your business as usual, folks, they say. Here's a clip from the now disgraced ex-progressive turncoat comedian Dennis Miller slamming climate change on, where else, Fox News.
And now it's time for tonight's The Buck Starts Here with Dennis Miller.
Hey folks, tonight I want to talk about global warming. Now the world is flat and hot society is growing increasingly hysterical, and that indeed is causing me to sweat a little. In the last month or so, I've heard suggestions that those skeptical of Al Gore's spiritual crisis are deniers. And one good way to serve the planet would be to have one less kid. I've also read that mankind is, quote, a virus, and human beings are, quote, the AIDS of the earth. Global warming is officially becoming creepy, and I can't tell yet if it's fascistic or fetishistic, but it's kind of like piercing or tattoos. I don't even want to get one because I see how hooked people are, and it spooks me. Simply put, I can't worry about the Earth right now because I'm too worried about the world. Why can't I take terrorism as seriously as Al Gore takes global warming? There are times you think that liberals only fear car bombs if they have leaky exhaust systems. And why am I constantly beaten over the head with the phrase, quote, the delicate balance of nature? Am I the only one who watches Animal Planet? Every time I turn it on, I see some demented harp seal chucking penguins down his gullet like they were maitre d' Tic Tacs. To me, nature always appears more unbalanced than Gary Busey with a clogged eustachian tube. Listen. The weather is just like Hillary's explanation of her war vote. We just don't know, do we? We're hit or miss on next Tuesday's weather, much less the year 2057. Relax. We'll replace oil when we need to. American ingenuity will kick in, and the next great fortune will be made. It's not pretty, but it is historically accurate. We need to run out of oil first. And that's why I drive an SUV, so we run out of it more quickly. I consider myself to be at the vanguard of the environmental movement. And I think individuals who insist on driving hybrids are just prolonging our dilemma, and I think that's just selfish. Come on. Don't you care about Mother Earth? Don't you? The buck starts.
Dennis Miller takes his cheap shots and wonders why Bush's war on terror can't be as popular as, well, saving the planet from extreme climate change. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let's turn off all those male voices from a dying generation and switch on a 13-year-old young woman. From Vancouver, Severin Suzuki is the daughter of the famous broadcaster and author David Suzuki. Here is her impassioned speech to the United Nations delegates on June 18, 2007.
Hello, I'm Severin Suzuki, speaking for ECHO, the Environmental Children's Organization. We're a group of 12 and 13-year-olds trying to make a difference. Vanessa Setti, Morgan Geisler, Michelle Quigg, and me. We've raised all the money to come here ourselves, to come 5,000 miles to tell you adults you must change your ways. Coming up here today, I have no hidden agenda. I am fighting for my future. Losing my future is not like losing an election or a few points on the stock market. I am here to speak for all generations to come. I am here to speak on behalf of the starving children around the world whose cries go unheard. I am here to speak for the countless animals dying across this planet because they have nowhere left to go. I am afraid to go out in the sun now because of the holes in our ozone. I'm afraid to breathe the air because I don't know what chemicals are in it. I used to go fishing in Vancouver, my home, with my dad, until just a few years ago we found the fish full of cancers. And now we hear of animals and plants going extinct every day vanishing forever. In my life, I have dreamt of seeing the great herds of wild animals, jungles and rainforests full of birds and butterflies. But now I wonder if they will even exist for my children to see. Did you have to worry of these things when you were my age? All this is happening before our eyes, and yet we act as if we have all the time we want and all the solutions. I'm only a child, and I don't have all the solutions. But I want you to realize, neither do you. You don't know how to fix the holes in our ozone layer. You don't know how to bring the salmon back up in a dead stream. You don't know how to bring back an animal now extinct. And you can't bring back the forest that once grew where there is now a desert. If you don't know how to fix it, please stop breaking it. Here, you may be delegates of your government, business people, organizers, reporters, or politicians, but really, your mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, aunts and uncles, and all of you are someone's child. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all part of a family, 5 billion strong, in fact, 30 million species strong. And borders and governments will never change that. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all in this together and should act as one single world towards one single goal. In my anger, I am not blind, and in my fear, I am not afraid of telling the world how I feel. In my country, you make so much waste. We buy and throw away, buy and throw away. Buy and throw away, and yet northern countries will not share with the needy. Even when we have more than enough, we are afraid to share. We are afraid to let go of some of our wealth. In Canada, we live the privileged life with plenty of food, water, and shelter. We have watches, bicycles, computers, and television sets. The list could go on for 2 days. 2 days ago, here in Brazil, we were shocked when we spent time with some children living on the streets. This is what one child told us. I wish I was rich. And if I were, I would give all the street children food, clothes, medicines, shelter, and love and affection. If a child on the streets who has nothing is willing to share, why are we who have everything still so greedy? I can't stop thinking that these are children my own age, that it makes a tremendous difference where you are born, that I could be one of those children living in the favelas of Rio. I could be a child starving in Somalia, or a victim of war in the Middle East, or a beggar in India. I am only a child, yet I know if all the money spent on war was spent on finding environmental answers, ending poverty, and finding treaties, what a wonderful place this earth would be. At school, even in kindergarten, you teach us how to behave in the world. You teach us to not to fight with others, to work things out, to respect others, to clean up our mess, not to hurt other creatures, to share, not be greedy. Then why do you go out and do the things you tell us not to do? Do not forget why you are attending these conferences, who you're doing this for. We are your own children. You are deciding what kind of a world we are growing up in. Parents should be able to comfort their children by saying, everything's going to be all right. It's not the end of the world, and we're doing the best we can. But I don't think you can say that to us anymore. Are we even on your list of priorities? My dad always says, you are what you do, not what you say. Well, what you do makes me cry at night. You grown-ups say you love us, but I challenge you, please, make your actions reflect your words. Thank you.
That was 13-year-old Severin Suzuki speaking at the United Nations on June 18th. I was happy to find this clip on YouTube because it's about time the next generation gets active, early, on the problems that threaten to rearrange their world, and not in a good way. We all know we have to do something about our addiction to fossil fuels. Even George Bush admits it. And we know that fossil fuels won't go on forever. Last week in the Canadian CBC television program The Map with Avi Lewis, I heard an expert from Alberta confirm that Canada's natural gas supplies will run out in 10 years' time. We all use this stuff to heat our homes, and so do half the houses in America. 10 years? Even I was shocked. I haven't had the chance to really confirm this timetable yet. But there is no doubt the era of cheap natural gas is coming to a close, along with cheap oil. There is a whole movement of people and experts who say the world's oil reserves have been greatly exaggerated by OPEC members in order to give themselves a bigger quota, and by big oil companies who want to protect their stock prices. It's called the peak oil movement, and one of their prime websites is globalpublicmedia.com. Meanwhile, big environmental groups are trying to get alternative energy sources due to carbon pollution in the atmosphere wrecking the climate. Until recently, these two movements have operated fairly independently, as though the other didn't exist. Today we have a fascinating interview done by Julian Darley, one of the driving forces behind the peak oil movement and founder of Global Public Media. He talks with Dr. Jeremy Leggett, a geologist who worked with Greenpeace International for many years and now speaks widely on peak oil. With Greenpeace, Leggett successfully lobbied huge insurance companies to take notice of climate change, given the record-breaking claims paid out for extreme climate events, such as hurricanes. Now he is advocating a crash program, switching to renewables, and going back to localized production and agriculture. So Leggett is in a perfect place to tell us how these two theories of why we should get off oil intersect. Here is Julian Darley interviewing Dr. Jeremy Leggett on June 17, 2007.
This is Julian Darley for Global Public Media on the 17th of June 2007, and I'm talking to Jeremy Leggett, CEO of Solar Century in the UK and author of the book Half Gone. Jeremy, could you tell us a little bit about the advent of the article in The Independent and your role in it and what they've told you about that?
Well, the Independent has, over the period of the peak oil debate, been mildly interested, I would have said, up to now. But just the other day when the BP report, the statistical review, was published, I got a call from one of their correspondents saying they're saying the same as they've always said. There's 40 years of supply. The new regime is no different from the others, and we think that there's an interesting story here. So I did the obvious and talked them through what so many people in ASPO now believe and put them in touch with the people I felt they should talk to first, Colin Campbell, Chris Grabowski, and the rest is history. That turned into a front page story. I used the word story in inverted commas because there was nothing in it that would have been news to anyone who's remotely interested in the peak oil debate. But the fact is the British newspaper has now run a major front page story, and they tell me that they intend to revisit this subject regularly in the same way that they did with climate change. In other words, they're going to turn it into a bit of a campaign, which, if that happens, will be wonderful news.
What do you think the significance of a campaign by a major and serious newspaper might be?
Well, in the UK, certainly, peak oil is a visible story, but it's not one that is in any way it's a completely a minority view. And I think that if a newspaper were to have a cadre of correspondents that understood the issue and were able to revisit it on a regular basis, this would start to accrete a readership, a group of people who would go to that newspaper for information on the subject, and this could only help. In a best-case analysis, it will actually lead to a sort of tipping point of concern, and other papers will follow suit. But, maybe that's being too over-optimistic about the thing.
Well, speaking of other newspapers, there are some in The Guardian who certainly know about it. Do you see The Guardian having any rising concern? I mean, there's George Monbiot, Larry Elliott, The Economist with The Guardian.
Yes, there are a good few folks in The Guardian who seem to understand the issue. So there's another source of hope. The key paper, of course, would be the Financial Times. If there could be a realization in that paper that there's a problem with the issue, then I think we'll really be getting somewhere. But the tendency to date has been to accept the party line from BP and the others.
Another of the Times newspapers, the Times of London, is owned by Rupert Murdoch. And Rupert Murdoch has recently suggested that he has become very interested in climate change. And that leads me to wonder whether he may not one day become interested in peak oil and other resource issues and what effects that might have.
Quite so. And this is one of the points I made to The Independent, that in many ways the climate change debate at this juncture reminds me very much of the early years post-Rio in the climate change issue. So you've got a clearly growing trajectory of concern over the issue, but it's not yet reached critical mass. With climate change, as we know, it's definitely a critical mass now. And peak oil, yeah, could very well follow the same kind of trajectory of growing concern to the point where people actually begin to think about doing something about it, the same way as we are now beginning to do collectively with climate change.
Have you noticed any effect in the UK of the near mass conversion of America over to the climate understanding?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's resonating very interestingly in the UK, where all kinds of sectors are now getting substantive, as I think of it. As a campaigner for many years, I'm very well versed in recognizing greenwash. And many players in industry are beginning to go well beyond greenwash now. The retail sector, for example, the retail giants in the UK are beginning to compete with each other on climate change around a deep cuts trajectory. So, you know, it's not to be overstated what's happening at the moment, but neither is it to be understated. Things are beginning to move, and not before time, of course.
Well, even BP seems quite interested in it. Tony Hayward, the new chief of BP, mentions climate very prominently in the review, the statistical review.
Yes, but I do think BP and Shell have run out of steam. There's only so much they can do. Their performance on renewables has been close to, well, has been pretty dismal compared to the really aggressive entrepreneurial new entrants and new entrants big companies. And of course, when it comes to carbon sequestration that they both advocate strongly, BP has shut down the one major trial in carbon sequestration that they had going in the UK. So much as I think there's substantive action going on elsewhere, I don't think that applies to BP or Shell, unfortunately.
Turning to a related matter, in the sense of combining peak oil and climate, you originally started in the oil industry, I believe, and then you became highly aware of climate matters quite a long time ago and campaigned around that and still do. And then recently, is it fair to say you had some kind of a conversion to peak oil? I think it was after Shell's revisions 3 or so years ago. You are in a very interesting position, therefore, to comment and look at the situation in which some people in the peak oil world have difficulties with the notion of climate change, and some people in the climate change world have difficulties with the notion of peak oil and natural gas and so forth. Can you give us some commentary on that?
Yes, I've had a foot in both camps, and I do regret that there isn't more appreciation of peak oil in the environmental community and vice versa. And I think that has been a problem, and that currently still is and will probably continue to be for a while. That said, I think there's something understandable about it, because both these issues now are pretty complex. To be on top of what's going on, given the speed of movement in developments in both climate change and peak oil, you've really got to be a bit of a scholar. You've got to be prepared to invest study time and do it across a broad front, not in a selective way. So I think very few people have the time to do this. The peak oil experts really can't be delving around in the type of literature where the really worrying stuff is coming out in climate change. And so many folks in the peak oil community, being good soldiers of the oil industry, are naturally predisposed to that view that has been so common in the oil industry, that climate change is not sound science. You know, all the mantras of the deniers and contrarians, you know, ExxonMobil. Similarly, in the environmental camp, I think there's been a sort of cultural predisposition to think that if, you know, your enemies are going to have lots of resources, and often a failure to understand geology and flow rates. So the kinds of arguments that Colin Campbell and Aspo put over on reserves, and the kinds of arguments that Chris Skrabowski and others who concentrate on the flow rates put across, you know, these aren't things that environmentalists tend to understand. So those of us who have the fortune or misfortune of having a foot in both camps, or, you know, the ability to understand both sets of arguments, and really, rather sadly, the willingness to invest the amount of spare time to just about keep up with both fast-moving fields, have a particular responsibility to kind of try and bring both camps together as best we can in constructive discussion.
What do you think that might happen in the world, either natural events, geological, economical, political, ideational? What kinds of things might help these two camps to understand one another better?
Well, you know, Julian, I wish I could persuade myself that we could be proactive about this. I hope I'm wrong in this analysis, but I really rather think we don't have time, and that what's going to happen is that the march of events in oil and gas depletion, combined with geopolitics, are going to hit us fairly soon. And that will play out the way it will play out. The rubber will begin to hit the road on the choices that will have to be made in the wake of the energy collapse once it happens. And then it'll become clear to people that these two issues are really, really convergent, because at that point, if we're then foolish enough to go for the unconventional oil and gas deposits and coal and liquids from coal and all the rest of it in a world where we haven't, you know, and we haven't sorted out any semblance of a global sequestration regime, then, you know, that's the worst of all possible outcomes. But I live in hopes that there's so much activity around efficiency, fuel conservation, and renewable energy, alternative fuels, that will go down that road predominantly and do the best we can to engineer a renaissance out of the back of the next great global energy crisis.
Well, on that positive note, that practical note, even if it's tinged with more complex understandings, I want to thank you very, very much. That was Jeremy Leggett, CEO of Solar Century and author of the book Half Gone. And I am Julian Daly for Global Public Media on the 17th of June, 2007.
For lots more audio, interviews, and articles, go to globalpublicmedia.com.
That was Julian Darley of globalpublicmedia.com interviewing Dr. Jeremy Leggett on June 17th. Interesting, no? The big British oil company, BP, which used to mean British Petroleum but now means Beyond Petroleum, says not to worry. Climate change concerns will shut down the oil industry before the oil runs out. In either case, it's a race to the finish in more ways than one. You have been listening to the Radio EcoShock show. Find this show and our past adventures as free MP3 downloads at our website at www.ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith, and keep on listening, or you're all going to die. Just kidding. We are all going to die, but hopefully not in floods, droughts, and forest fires. Bye for now.
I'm going cruising in my woody, lighting up my barbecue.